Welcome to the Composer's Studio Podcast. On the Composer's Studio, we listen to the music of living composers. We talk to them about their writing process, and we learn about the world of music that they live and work in.
I'm Anna Linville.
And I'm Tara Ghirardella. And today on the Composer's Studio, we are speaking with composer Aaron Noe. Aaron is a conductor, educator, and jazz trumpet player who has a passion for wind band. As a trumpet player, Aaron has performed with many great musicians, including the late great legend of jazz, James Moody, as well as Eric Marienthal. Aaron Noe founded the Mid-Atlantic Wind Symphony, also called MAWS, an international wind ensemble comprised of professional musicians from the Mid-Atlantic region volunteering their time to promote professional-level wind band literature. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, man. So how are you liking living in North Carolina, in Hillsborough in particular?
We love it. I just can't wait until I can see more of it.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
That must have been a real challenge for you to, you get this new gig and you come down to Hillsborough and then you're just thrust into this COVID reality that we're in and you can't really get teaching the way you're supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not ideal, but I'm amazed at the kids, to be honest with you, because they're rolling with it. They're keeping me on my toes because I'm trying to figure out, how to engage them in a virtual setting. I mean, I can't wait until we can get into the band room and start making some music together, but they're doing great.
So you're teaching wind band, and this is one of your major passions. How did you get into band music?
Well, grew up in the coastal region of North Carolina, and we started band in seventh grade, and I went into band. Originally, I wanted to play saxophone like every other kid in the world, but my parents had just bought my brother a beautiful Bach Strad trumpet, which is a professional level instrument. They bought it for him his ninth grade year, and he quit after his ninth grade year, just as I was going into seventh grade. They had just invested all this money into a beautiful trumpet, and they said, nope, you're going to play trumpet. So that's kind of how I became a trumpet player. I went to three different high schools. I went to Pender High School in Burgall, North Carolina. And then my 10th grade year, we moved to Wilmington. I went to E.A. Laney, which had a wonderful band program. Levy Gilliard was the band director there, and he was phenomenal, kind enough to let me come in and be a part of he was just very welcoming, and having a big move like that in 10th grade was a lot to handle, but I instantly had a family. And then in the middle of my junior year, we moved out to Fairfax, Virginia, which the Fairfax bands are just phenomenal. They are known around the U.S. for just being phenomenal band programs. And same thing, Mary Ulrey was my band director there. And we contacted her before moving up there. She was kind enough to set aside an evening where my dad and I drove up before we moved up. She listened to me, auditioned me, and was kind enough to put me in on the top ensemble with them and gave me a pass to play. And I think with all the turmoil, the only constant was the music and, being able to make those connections with people immediately. And it had a really profound impact on me. I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about music and band in particular.
Some of our listeners are, they're in Europe and there are other places in the world where there isn't this marching band culture. If aliens landed at a modern marching band competition, how would you explain American marching band culture to them?
That's a loaded question, because there's actually lots of different styles of marching band even here in the U.S. I mean, you've got the vast majority of bands today are heavily influenced by Drum Corps International, DCI, which is a summer program that students audition the ages 16 to 21. They audition for these phenomenal musical groups, and they just put on these incredible shows while marching at breakneck speeds and just have this beautiful sound. They're all brass and percussion. They don't have the woodwinds yet, but that may change. But there is a lot of the high school programs and are really heavily influenced by that. And they kind of go in that where they're putting a lot of this artistic music on the field, and they tell a story. They have, you'll hear everything from Holst, Beethoven, and then some contemporary stuff that really, tell a whole musical story. But then you've got, the college marching bands are very different. You've got, where their halftime shows are really geared towards keeping the audiences engaged at the halftime show. So there's a very much, you'll hear a lot more pop music in their stuff. And then, there's some really old school pockets in parts of Texas, Ohio, that actually do like a very traditional where they will actually get out there and march the old military style, which is, anybody that ever marched in the military, you have a 30-inch step, so that's 6 to the 5-yard line. And they'll march in blocks, straight lines. They'll do the old pinwheels, everything's where, the DCI is very fluid and stuff like that. And they're out there playing old Sousa marches or Fillmore marches out on the field. So it's actually pretty diverse. And, Anna, it's actually, it's picking up steam around the world. I've got a friend in Ireland that is starting up some, they call them show bands, but these marching bands, and they get out there and perform and have these competitions. And you actually have, what is it, the World Association of Marching Show Bands, I think it's WAMSB. And it's actually, we're having a huge influence in Japan. They have some incredible indoor and outdoor marching competitions, and other pockets around the world are actually picking it up. So I guess it may be our influence here in America in the band world.
So my son's in marching band, and in fact, you're his director. He's an 11th grader. First competition I went to where he was performing, one of the bands actually brought a working waterfall onto the field.
Yeah.
It was insane. I was just like, what is this? What am I looking at here? It was the craziest thing.
One year with one of my high school programs, we actually, the title of the piece was Stonehenge, and we actually constructed these Stonehenge monoliths that were like the backdrop. The band boosters created these amazing, basically constructed Stonehenge in a semicircle on the field. And it was amazing watching them push those things out. And it is a different world, to say the least.
I know that you had started an organization when you were up in Virginia called MAWS, which stands for Mid-Atlantic Wind Symphony. How did that get started? And inform us, tell us a little bit about the organization.
You know, DC, you have these amazing military bands up there. You've got, the President's Own, you've got the Air Force Band, you've got the Navy Band, and, Pershing's Own Army Band. Not a lot of people may realize a lot of those people in those bands, they have performance degrees at the master's level or the doctorate level, but they are enlisted. So a lot of those musicians will actually live outside of the DC area because they can afford to get a place outside of there. And then, just north of Fredericksburg, you've got the Quantico Marine Corps base, which has a wonderful band there. On top of that, you've got a lot of private studio musicians in the area there that have their own teaching studios. And a lot of them love wind band music, as well as, band directors. Obviously they enjoy playing too, but they may not have the time commitment to give to a community band that meets every week, is rehearsing once a week, and then putting on performances, but they are interested in wind band music. And so I started this group. We would do 3 to 4 concerts a year, and we would treat it like a professional performance where we would have a reading session 2 weeks out. They take the music home with them after we kind of read through some stuff, established tempo, and kind of went over some basics of style and stuff like that. And then we would come back. We'd do a Friday evening rehearsal, a Saturday morning rehearsal, and then Sunday afternoon we would do a concert performance. And, you know, the musicians that came loved that. And the Quantico band would join us. Some of the musicians that had retired from some of those DC bands that were in the Fredericksburg area would join us. The private studio musicians, as well as a lot of band directors, would come and join us. And they really appreciated that that approach because it allowed them an artistic outlet without the time commitment that would come with like joining a community band.
Speaking of time, the first piece we want to listen to of yours is called Time Machine. And we thought we'd start with this one because we were talking about education, about the importance of, you know, about how you got into music and your passion for teaching. And can you just tell us a little bit about this piece and why you composed it?
I composed it specifically for young bands. You know, probably a band in their second year would be able to play this piece. And it introduces them to minor tonality as well as a change in meter and a change in style. So hence the name Time Machine. They kind of get to experience an expanded piece, a little bit expanded. It's not a terribly long piece, but a little bit longer piece with the opening section, a slower section, and then that driving section as kind of a recapitulation, but still in the same key, basically just a repeat of the opening there.
This is Time Machine by composer Aaron Noe.
That was Time Machine by composer Aaron Noe. Aaron, I'm curious about the title. You know, time, obviously, as it plays a very important role in music in many different ways. And I was curious if there was any play on the word in this piece and what the title meant for you.
Well, yes. When I was writing it, you know, just the driving, the snare drum behind it, kind of gave me this idea of listening to a machine kind of going through. And then, you know, to me, time is probably the most important element of it's what makes music, because, you know, we can have sounds and we can have pitches and stuff like that, but it's the actual putting those within the concept of time that makes it musical. And, you know, it's one of those concepts as an educator, we're constantly teaching things about time. And, so it was a play on words there, but also that middle section, I kind of envisioned it as kind of taking a step back in time a little bit. It kind of, to me, it kind of sounded a little bit like folk music, I guess, was kind of the image there. So just kind of play off of that idea of a time machine also. So it's kind of got multiple levels of interpretation, I guess.
How important is it to you that good music for all levels is available for players so that they have high quality experience? You were telling us part of the reason you composed this was because there was nothing for that particular level.
Nothing that I had written. It's extremely important that we try to find good music written by the very best composers, regardless of what level they're playing in. From an educational standpoint, as an educator, I feel, you know, percentage-wise, there's a very small percentage of my students that are going to go on to have careers in the field of music. So where does that leave me? I want to make sure that I am teaching them to appreciate quality music so that they can be the patrons, the concert audiences for great music, so that what we do carries on to the next generation.
And were some of the musicians in your adult group, the you know, you talked about some of the professionals and the military people, but were there some new musicians, people starting out later in life, who were part of that organization as well?
I had a friend of mine. He played a lot as a young man, and he actually has some amazing, he was a great trombonist. When he was a young guy, he actually got to play with like Frank Sinatra and stuff like that when people came into DC, and life caught up with him when he was young, wound up having a family. He put the horn down and went and developed his career. And then, you know, one of his friends that continued to play, he was a retired trombonist and arranger and composer for the Airmen of Note, met up with him and said, "Jim, you need to get back into playing again. You were such a great player." And he had put the horn down for like 30 years. And then he decided to pick it up, got back into it. And it was absolutely amazing. And he was a regular part of a lot of different groups in that area. He played with jazz groups. He played with the Mid-Atlantic Wind Symphony. He played with the local symphony orchestra, the Pops Orchestra, and stuff like that. So it was kind of cool to see, I guess, that rebirth and that passion come back into his playing and everything. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, as a composer, and you had mentioned that, you know, you write for different age groups and different levels. How does this affect your creativity? And what I mean by that is, you know, when you're writing for grade 3 or you're writing for, you know, grade 11, do you still find ways to get your creativity across? And how do you have to navigate through that as you're composing?
Sometimes it's harder to write for younger ensembles because your creativity can take you in a lot of different directions. And then you have to sit back and realize, you know, can a seventh grader actually play this musical thought? Or can, a young high school group play this musical thought? So in a lot of ways, it winds up putting weights. It's like working out with weights on. Have to take a step back. It kind of slows down the process, but causes you to kind of rethink and say, how can I make a statement like this that is accessible to a younger person? You know, when I wrote for Mid-Atlantic, it didn't matter as much what I wrote on the page. Those musicians could play it. So I had a lot more freedom to to do some stuff with them. I had some amazing flutists and piccolo players that, you know, I would write runs all over the place. And, you know, if I was writing for a young high school group, I would scale that back considerably. So the answer to that is yes, it all comes into play when trying to come up with ideas and stuff like that. But to be honest with you, I feel that a lot of my inspiration comes from specific groups that I'm writing for. And a lot of the stuff that I've written has been influenced by that group.
Got it. So you're always composing for the ensemble that you're writing for.
Quite often, yeah.
Well, the next piece we're going to listen to is Russian Folk Songs. And this is a 3-movement work exploring the beauty and grandeur of old Russia. Is this your cultural background?
No.
What draws you to the Russian folk songs?
So it was 2017. And, you know, stepping back to 2017, you know, Russia was in the news everywhere. And so we did a concert. We titled it From Russia with Love. We wound up programming a James Bond medley. We did a couple other pieces, and I started looking around for band works that had Russian folk songs because, you know, in the political arena, you know, sometimes we look at a country through the lens of politics and we don't really look beyond that and look at the people and the heritage of the people. And, you know, when you look at the Russian people and their heritage from a cultural standpoint, there's a lot of beauty there, and their folk music has a lot of character to it. And I wanted to kind of highlight that a little bit. And that was the inspiration for writing this, was specifically for that concert.
This is Russian Folk Songs, composed by Aaron Noe. Thank you. That was Russian Folk Songs by composer Aaron Nowy. We heard three movements. One, The Road to Petersburg. Two, A Cossack Lullaby. And three, Glorious Baikal. Those are really beautiful pieces. The level and the richness and the emotion of the music. I think often, one, folk music does not get often proper, does not get properly regarded as being something that can be so emotional like that. And two, I find that a lot of people don't find the wind repertoire to tug at the heartstrings like that as much. Do you find the same thing?
You know, it's funny that you say that because the folk song tradition actually has a very endearing place within the band community. And I think a lot of it stems from when Holst and Vaughan Williams wrote their suites for band. Both of those pieces were composed off of English folk songs. And, you know, you look at the great composers, you look at Copland. Copland used a lot of folk music within his compositions to help convey a story or to share an idea and everything. So I think it's, in the band world specifically, it's very much a part of what we do. It influences a lot. I think also in a lot of the classical music as well.
Yeah. You know, the next piece we're going to listen to, Shall We Gather at the River, is an American folk song, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was set by Aaron Copland, actually set it as an art song in his old American songs. It's a really amazing song cycle of American folk songs, and very some of my favorite pieces ever written, and very emotional. You know, you've taken this in a different and given a different treatment than Copland did. He took this piece and made it. It was much slower and much more, more like a ballad.
And just this is not a a piece by me. This is actually Henry Fillmore wrote this. Shall We Gather at the River? This arrangement. But this is one of the things that I love doing. Is you know, I'm a total band geek through and through. I love to look at the history of wind band music, and there's a ton of stuff that was published in the late 19th, early 20th century that, there was a ton of stuff published, and a lot of it is gotten lost in places, and there's a couple of sites that are kind of saving this music and, you know, scanning it to PDF and stuff like that. But a lot of these things don't have scores to look at because those early, mm-hmm. The role of the conductor in a lot of those old bands, they were also, you know, maybe the solo cornetist or the solo clarinet player. So you'd have the parts would just be not even a reduced score. It would just have their line with some, notes over top of it, and there was no full score with this. So one of the things that I love to do is when I find a piece that I like, is to actually take it and script it out. And with those old arrangements, they're really overscored because they were designed to serve two purposes. One was as a march outside, but they were also, you know, in the early 20th century, the town band was a huge thing, but the instrumentation of the town band varied from city to city. So the publishers would over-arrange the compositions so that all the parts would be heard, you know, with the different instrumentation. So when a concert ensemble plays some of these classic marches, you should take you know, really look at it and adjust kind of the way that you would play it. Sousa was huge with doing this with his own compositions, and it developed into what we refer to now as the Sousa style. So I'll take some of these old marches and, you know, create a new score from them, just basically a straight transcription, adding some stuff to make it a little bit easier to read than on those small little charts, but also put in some of these ideas that a concert conductor would have done with their band during this time, telling them. And you know, some of the things that they would do is in certain strains of the march, they would have they would take out the trumpets, they would take out the trombones, they would have take out the piccolo, they would have the flutes and the clarinets actually play it down an octave, play it very soft the first or second time through, and then come back with a really big section with everybody playing you know, as written 2D, and you know, just have a lot of contrast to it. And so the scores that are right have a lot of those indications of ways that you can make it adaptable to for a concert presentation rather than playing it outside with everybody just playing all the parts loud all the time.
This is Shall We Gather at the River, arranged and edited by Aaron Noe. Shall We Gather at the River, arranged by Aaron Noe. We were talking about where you get your source material from. In some cases, it could be folk music. In other cases, it could be arranging and working with other pieces. I was just curious, do you have a method of finding the content or the music that you want to use in your pieces?
I'm always listening to different things. And I'm constantly searching for different things that may appeal to me, I guess. So I wind up finding them in a lot of different places. So I don't know if there's any specific place that I look in particular.
What would you say is the most unusual, you know, source of inspiration you've had as a composer when you really found a treasure and it was just an unlikely place?
I wrote a piece for my younger band one time called Ballad of the Spanish Cavalier. And it was an old folk song that was sung, and it just kind of tells the story of this Spanish cavalier going off to war, leaving his lover behind, and wanted to return to her, but in the end doesn't return because of the war. And it's a simple song, and I wrote it for a young band group, but because I'm an American and you know, I'm influenced not necessarily by the Spanish culture, but by the Mexican culture. I have a lot of mariachi style influences in that piece, while also using that original melody as the basis for it. So that was kind of the weirdest place I got it from. Mm-hmm. It was just like a folk song that I saw somebody sing on YouTube somewhere, and it became the source for that composition.
That's amazing. So the next piece we're going to listen to is Fugue on a Theme by Corelli. Now, this is a completely different source material.
Yeah.
Corelli was a Baroque violin virtuoso. So why Corelli?
Well, it's actually a Bach fugue, and he wrote it for organ, and he's the one that it is his composition. And then I took and I arranged it for the wind ensemble. And, you know, as a band director, one of the things that we strive for is to get the band to play together and in time with one another, because you'll have, 50 musicians on stage, and, we want them to come together. One of the images that we always relate to are, it's common to relate to this image to the ensemble, is that of an organ player, that the organist is playing and all these wind sounds are coming out of the pipes and everything. So this was a Bach fugue that I just arranged for the wind ensemble.
Thank you.
was Fugue on a Theme by Corelli, composed by Johann Sebastian Bach and arranged by Aaron Noe. Aaron, there are so many different sides to you as a musician. We were talking at the beginning of the show about the instrument that you play, the trumpet. And I know that outside of wind ensemble and wind band, you also play jazz. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your jazz playing.
Well, jazz was really the direction I thought I was going to go in as a musician. I've always been passionate about jazz. When I moved out to Fairfax, it was a really cool scene outside of D.C. I remember going to Alexandria, and they had this club on King Street called the 219 Club. And on Sunday afternoons, they would have an open jam session, and I would go up there with my little etude books, my jazz books that had the heads, and I'd be working on stuff all week with the tape accompaniments because I'm that old. They weren't CDs at the time, they were tapes. The leader of the band was kind enough on the last set, and I'd show up there like on the first set, and he would let me come up on the third final set on last tune and play along with the band. And it just it was such a cool thing to just get up there and create spontaneously. And I think that's when I look at jazz improvisation, I've always thought of it as being composing on the spot. I just love that creative aspect of jazz. And, you know, I've played a lot. I've been blessed to play with some really amazing musicians, some great groups, and it's been a blast.
We talked about your experience playing with James Moody and Eric Marienthal. And you want to tell us that story? How did that happen?
Well, the James Moody story, it's one of those stories that you wouldn't believe it unless it actually happened. I got a phone call one time, and it was this this agent in Florida. And he'd been contacted by this organization. They were having this big benefit down in the Hampton area of Virginia. And their whole thing was that they wanted to have this all-star big band perform. And they were going to have some huge names in jazz perform. And, you know, when the agent told them the price that it would cost, they were like, oh, I can't do that. So this agent started looking around for Virginia big bands and came across my site and gave me a call and said, hey, I came across you. I listened to your stuff. You sound like a really good ensemble. I'm going to forward your information to this client that is wanting this group on this date. And so the lady called me and hired my big band to go play this gig in Hampton. And, you know, I was getting ready to put together the contract, send it out to her. You know, I was stoked because big band gigs are, they're expensive. So you don't get as many of those. You get picked up as a jazz combo or something. So it's always cool to get a full big band gig. So I was putting together the contract, and like an hour and a half later, the same lady called me and she said, you know, Mr. Noe, we've been really thinking. And at that moment, I was like, oh, you know what? I've just lost this gig because they probably decided to go ahead and fund and get this jazz all-star. But she said, you know, one of our members, her uncle is James Moody, and we really want him to play on this evening. And I was like, well, I could totally get that. I know why I'm not getting the gig anymore. And then she said, would you mind if he played along with your big band? I was like, you know, after I picked my jaw up off the ground, I was like, yeah, we can do that. So it was... So, you know, we got to back him on one of the sets, and it was one of the most amazing things. I mean, James Moody is, he's from a compositional standpoint, he played a solo one time on I'm in the Mood for Love. And that solo actually became a common jazz standard called Moody's Mood. And, you know, that's just tells you the next level of improvisation that James Moody had. And, you know, it was kind of cool after the show. He was such a beautiful person. The whole sax section, they were just amazed. He spent like 45 minutes to an hour just hanging out with the other saxophones. They were trading licks. They were, he'd listen to them and say, oh, yeah, that was really cool. Try this right here. And then he'd play a lick. They'd play it back. And it was a beautiful moment. I mean, it was beautiful to be able to create music there, but just to actually meet him and interact with him. I mean, he was just such a beautiful soul, you know?
This is an etude for trumpet by composer Theo Charlier, arranged by Aaron Noe. And Aaron Noe performs on this recording. That was awesome, man. Where did you have a chance to take a breath?
Yeah. it's definitely a kicker. That's for sure. But it's one of those etudes that, as an undergrad trumpet player, the Charlier book is one that we work on. And, the second etude is a beautiful lyric etude that is used often in a lot of auditions just to hear your lyrical playing. And that first etude is just like a fun little articulation etude. But I heard a chord progression that went along with it, and I just kind of tried it out to see what it sounded like, and I thought it sounded cool, you know? All the jazz purists out there are going to probably turn their nose up to it because it's not legit, but that's cool. I had fun doing it.
Yeah, man.
Well, one thing we've learned is I think people just do what they want to do now. There's no legit or there's no, you know, you can do what you want. You're only limited by your own questioning of yourself.
Most
your
definitely.
So that's what's so amazing about today's about contemporary composition is just the huge variety of work being done and the huge amount of creativity.
The next piece we're going to listen to, Taken by the Sky, you know, one thing that jumps right out at me, certainly did when I first listened to it, was this swashbuckling quality to it. You know, I immediately thought of the composer Korngold and all the scores he did, you know, for the Errol Flynn movies like Robin Hood and Seawolf, and it just had that feel to it. And I was wondering if that was intentional, and what was the piece written for, or was there any specific reason for it?
That was actually a commission by Skiatook High School in Oklahoma. And in talking with the director, he told me a story. And apparently there's this local legend about the name Skiatook that has gone around and about this old, the original settlement of that area was swept away by this tornado. And when the people came to find the rubble there, they asked what had happened. And the locals there said the Skiatook it. And hence the name Skiatook became the name of the town there once they rebuilt. So the opening of it is very much that exciting feel to it. But I was trying to, I kept thinking about this tornado kind of just this whirlwind of sound rushing through. And then the after effect, there's this middle section, which is very flowing and, you know, just kind of emotional and, you know, just part of that rebuilding situation. And then we come back to that original statement, but not in a negative way, I guess. But that's kind of the images I had in my mind as I was writing this.
So is this, what's the structure of this piece? You were talking about, you know, you had a, it started out with a fast, furious, kind of chaotic section and then moved to something.
Definitely ABA.
So for a non-composer, that would be like in poetry where you have the A section being similar at the beginning and end, and then a middle contrasting
right.
section.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today on the Composer Studio. And thank you so much for all the work you do to continue the tradition of composition and build the love of music in your students. I mean, people like you really, we've had so many composers on the show who got their start and their love of music from a high school band program or a middle school band program. So you guys, you teachers are the heroes of American music. And I really feel that for everything we do in American schools, the music programs that we have in our public schools are, we're doing something right there. It shows in the composers that we produce as a nation. So thank you for your service.
Thank you. You're very kind. I appreciate, I really appreciate the invitation and just the opportunity to talk and share. It's been a blast. I really appreciate it.
It was awesome to meet you. We're going to close the show now by listening to Taken by the Sky by composer Aaron Noe. Thank you.
You have been listening to the music of Aaron Noe on the Composer Studio. If you've enjoyed Aaron's music, or if you are a band conductor and want to buy a score, you can find out more about Aaron Noe and his music on www.aamanomusic.com. That's www.amanomusic.com/Aaron-Noe. Noe is spelt N-O-E. We hope you've enjoyed the show.
We've just launched a new blog on our website where you can find playlists, composer links, videos, and bonus material. So if you liked what you heard and want to know more, check it out at www.composerstudio.net.
Thanks to our patrons for making this show possible. If you'd like to become a patron, just go to our website and click the Become a Patron button. We appreciate your support.
As John Philip Sousa once said, music is a moral law. It gives soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and charm and gaiety to life and to everything. Talk to you guys next week.